This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Guess what? A couple days ago, I washed my hair. I got all ready. I recorded this whole video. Spent like an hour and a half doing it. And when I went to go check it out, it wasn't there. And so I'm having to do it again. My hair is not as clean today. There's so much dry shampoo in my hair. There's like 12 pounds of dry shampoo in my hair today. No open flames for me today. Let me begin by introducing myself. I'm Reagan Snyder. And I have a podcast. If you're into more audio-based stories, I have a podcast. And it's over on wherever you listen to podcasts. But it's a new year. And we're doing some new stuff. So I'm coming over to YouTube too. And I'm making videos. So maybe it's good that video didn't capture, because I probably needed some practice. Anyway, if you are interested in true crime, which is what this is, I'm one of many, may I suggest that you subscribe to this channel, because I'm going to be pumping out content as much as I can. Today's case is about the Barbie and Ken killers. Why do they always give cute names to bad guys, you know? So there are most cases make me want to puke, but this is a case that makes me want to puke right through my nose, just right through it, projectile vomit. It's just nasty, the things that some people do, okay? We're going to talk about the Barbie of this case right now. Her name's Carla Homolka. Carla lived in Canada, and she was pretty and she was blonde, hence the Barbie name. But she wasn't only pretty, okay? She was smart. She had an IQ of 132, which, if that means nothing to you like it did to me, because I don't know about IQ stuff, I don't even know what my IQ is, but I can't imagine it's very high. And we're going to find out about IQs. IQ scale. To give you an idea of the IQ scale, 70, if you score 70 to 84, you are borderline mentally disabled. If you score 85 to 114, you're of average intelligence. 115 to 129, you're above average or bright on the bright side. If you're scoring between 130 or 144, you are moderately gifted. Carla was moderately gifted. And then we might as well just polish off the rest of this scale. 145 to 159 is highly gifted. Okay, so now you know. Now we know, because I didn't know, but now we know. Carla had two sisters. She was the oldest. There was Tammy right below her. And at this time that this story is taking place, Carla was 17 years old. Tammy was 15. And then Lori, the youngest sister, I'm not quite sure how old she was, but she was the youngest. And the parents, their parents' names were Carell and Dorothy Homolka. And their marriage was a little bit volatile. Carell was a traveling salesman, and so he was gone a lot. But when he was home, it seemed like him and Dorothy were always fighting. Carell was an alcoholic, and so that led to a whole bunch of tension in their marriage. So it wasn't really what you would call a peaceful household. And Carla, like many of us, me and you, she had an obsession with true crime. But it wasn't like a normal obsession. She took it a little bit further than she should have. She wanted to immerse herself in it and be part of it. She would fantasize about death, and she would even cut herself with a knife. Boop, red flag. And Carla is in high school, right? She's like a senior? And she had this boyfriend named Doug, and together they would experiment with sex and drugs, and they didn't care what you thought. They didn't care what anybody thought. Okay, they were cool, and they're bad. And although Carla was a bad girl and she had all these dark fantasies, she also had a little bit of a soft side. She had a little fuzzy heart for her little fuzzy friends. She loved animals. And so it's 1987 now, right? She's 17 and she gets a job at a vet clinic. And one weekend there was this pet food convention that she and another coworker went to together. And while they were there, they decided to get dinner one night. So they go to this restaurant and they're sitting there and they're eating and they're visiting, and in walks Paul Bernardo. It was slow motion and the wind was blowing through his hair, which I imagine was feathered. And he made eye contact with Carla. And Carla's like, their connection was instant. There was no denying it. They were just having a whole meet cute in this restaurant after the pet food convention. Paul was handsome, hence the Ken, Barbie and Ken. He was tall, he had blonde hair, and he was an older man. He was in college. He was 23. He was studying accounting at the University of Toronto. And he wasn't about to let his chance go by to get to know Carla. Okay, he saw something he liked and he wanted to have it. And so he approached her. And they were hitting it off. Love at first sight. And the coworker's still there and she's like, nobody likes to be a third wheel. And so the coworker's like, I'm gonna go. And so Carla's like, bye. Super into Paul. Carla and Paul, they ended up staying at this little restaurant and just talking and talking and talking and flirting and batting their eyes at each other and falling in love. And then the restaurant was closing and they're like, yoo-hoo, we're closing. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. And so Carla's like, why don't you come back to my place? I'm in a hotel. I have a hotel room. And Paul's like, okay. So they leave together and they go to Carla's hotel room. When they got to the hotel room, they had some relations. Carla's only 17, Paul's 23, but the age of consent in Canada is 16. So, you know, they're on the up and up. So while they're pillow talking, they're laying there and looking into each other's eyes and talking about death and all their dark fantasies and just really connecting over it. They learn from one another that they both like to watch people suffer. So now they know all about each other's dark fantasies, right? But Paul, any casual acquaintance or really friend of Paul would never guess this about him. He was charismatic and fun. He was the life of the party. If you were having a party, you wanted Paul to be there, because if Paul was going to be at the party, it was going to be lit if Paul was at the party. Deadass. So we know Paul's charismatic and fun and handsome. We also know that he likes to see people suffer. And Paul, well, he didn't have the best upbringing. He had a pretty normal childhood. He was born in 1964 to Kenneth and Marilyn Bernardo. And the first part of his childhood was good. He had a pretty good childhood. He was a happy, well-adjusted kid. But when he was 9, his family kind of fell apart because his dad was charged with being a freaking sexual predator of kids. He was charged with crimes around voyeurism and pedophilia. Kenneth would sexually abuse Paul's older sister, Deborah. And it wasn't like behind closed doors. He would do this in front of family members. He's just a sick piece of trash. And as you can imagine, Marilyn, his mom, went into a deep depression. She developed agoraphobia, and it was so bad that she completely withdrew and disconnected from the family and moved into the basement of the house and just isolated herself. And she's got kids, you know, and so this is affecting the kids. It's just kind of a mess at this point. The dad's a pedophile, the mom's agoraphobic, she doesn't leave the basement, and Paul seemed to be unfazed by this. But I'm sorry, but no. You know deep down he was not unfazed by this. You know this affected him, obviously, because we're here and he's in this story. But, you know, he didn't show it, but we know. We know. Time goes by and now Paul's 16. And he finds out that his dad, the kid toucher, isn't even his biological dad. For 16 years, he thought that was his biological dad. And it turns out that he wasn't. Because Marilyn apparently had a little bit of an affair. And that led to a pregnancy, and that pregnancy was Paul. So Paul's probably having an identity crisis at this point, because the guy he's been calling daddy is not only a terrible person, but he's also not his daddy. Paul was mad about this. That's how the whole thing manifested, was he was mad and he lashed out at his mom and they got into this big fight and they're calling each other terrible names, and it was just, the family was just broken at this point. And around this time, Paul started to pick up a little hobby on the side called peeping. He was a peeping Tom. He'd sneak around neighborhoods and look into people's windows, because that's what a peeping Tom is, you know? He also, as a kid, had pyromaniac inclinations, tendencies, and I don't know if you've heard of this, but there's a theory called the McDonald Triad, and it says that killers, or I hope I'm getting this right, serial killers all exhibit, I think, at least two of these three behaviors. One is pyromania, arson, interest in fires, and fire, animal cruelty, and bedwetting past the age of 5. Now, listen, I don't know Paul's bedwetting tendencies and habits, but he liked fire, and we know that. I don't know if he had any of the other two, but we do know something really dark and twisted that is just awful. So be warned, because this is awful. He would fantasize about creating a virgin farm where he would breed virgins so that he could grape them. That's what we're going to say. So that he could grape them. But all of this, as sick and twisted as that is, this was only just beginning. Because as he got older, his fantasies got darker. As he got older, he had this desire to humiliate and hurt women. So now he's in college, right? And he works for Amway, which was like, I don't know if you remember Amway, but they sold like household stuff and beauty products and all the things. And so he's a salesman for them. And he was charismatic, remember? And so he would pull in these girls. He would charm them using sales tactics. We like that, right? Like, use a sales tactic on me. I love it. Give me a car salesman. Oh, yeah, love that. And whenever he started dating someone, it would start out good, right? He put on the mask. It would go well for the first little while, because, you know, you gotta lure him in. You gotta get some charm and salesman tactics going. But then it would always turn abusive, but like sexually abusive. And they would run away from him. In one instance, he had a girlfriend who left him for one of his friends. And so in retaliation, he gathered up all of her things and he set fire to him. Classy move on both parts. So that's kind of his history, okay? It's now October of 1987. Paul and Carla are inseparable. Earlier that summer, there had been a series of brutal attacks in the area. And locals were on high alert because this person was still on the loose. This bad guy would stalk his victims. He would learn their routine and their habits and whatever. And then he would go and snatch them. And the media dubbed this guy the Scarborough Grapist. And so naturally the media is warning people, be on the lookout, keep an eye on your surroundings, be cautious, this guy is still on the loose. So fast forward to spring of 1989, Carla graduates high school, she's still dating Paul, and the mask was slipping for Paul a little bit. Things were getting a little bit abusive, but their relationship was not normal. It was more of a relationship of obsession. It wasn't healthy at all. It was very volatile. And Carla, of course, she would get mad at him for abusing her. He would like verbally abuse her. I don't know the extent of the abuse at this time, but I do know that he would verbally abuse her. And so she'd get mad about it. And then they'd make up quickly because they're obsessed with each other, and round they would go. At the end of that year, in December, Paul and Carla decide that they're going to go on a little lover's getaway together to Niagara Falls. And while they were there, Paul popped the question. And Carla's like, yes! Oh my gosh, 1,000 times yes! Even though you're abusive, yes! And so they're engaged now, and they're so happy, and they're so in love. And Carla's family was into this. They really liked Paul. I'm sure he put on the fun, charismatic, charming mask that everybody loved about Paul in front of them. And so they're excited about this engagement. They set their wedding date for sometime in 1991. Paul graduated college and then he got a job in accounting. But then in 1990, Paul lost his job and he's like, what am I going to do now? I have a degree. I could get another job, but smuggling cigarettes across the Canadian-US border sounds fun. So I'm going to do that. And so that's what he did. He was smuggling cigarettes. All the meanwhile, him and Carla are spending lots of time at her house with her family, and they obviously had no knowledge of his dark fantasies, probably not even of hers either, and they didn't know that he's smuggling cigarettes. They just really liked being around him. And in hanging out with Carla's family, he got to know Tammy, her 15-year-old sister. At some point, he ends up moving in with Carla and her family so that they can save money because, you know, they've got a wedding coming up. And life ain't cheap. And even though Paul was obsessed with Carla, he still had eyes for other girls. And this included Tammy, her very own 15-year-old sister, who he's now living with. They're all living together. He had a thing about virgins, and he didn't like that Carla was not a virgin. It was a major point of contention in their relationship. And Carla kind of felt like Paul was losing interest in her. And she's like, what do I do? I don't want to lose him. This is the man of my dreams. So whenever she felt like he was pulling away from her, she would just hold on tighter. And Carla knew about his obsession with Tammy. And so in an attempt to keep him with her, she offered up Tammy to him on a silver platter. Her very own sister, who's a child. She obviously knew about his sexual fantasies, and she encouraged them. And so to make things easier for him, she would assist him in access to Tammy. She would break her blinds, like just open them. I don't know, just open the blinds if that's what you're going to do. But she would break her blinds so that Paul could go out and peer into her window, you know, the whole peeping Tom thing. There were nights that he would sneak into Tammy's room while she was sleeping and just stand over her and himself. And for a while, this satisfied him, but then he needed more. And so he goes to Carla with this, and they're like, we need to come up with a plan. We need you satisfied, Paul. So in July of 1990, it's about 7 months into their engagement now, and Carla and Paul have this whole plan in place. Because Carla worked at a vet clinic, she had access to drugs and medications, like sedatives. So on July 24th, 1990, Carla stole some Valium from her work. And that night, while they were having dinner with Tammy, they crushed up the pills, sprinkled it into her spaghetti sauce. Poor Tammy's just trying to enjoy an Italian meal here, and they're crushing up Valium to knock her out. So Tammy falls asleep. She's unconscious, I guess. And Paul starts to sexually assault her. 1 minute into it, Tammy starts to wake up, and they're like, abort mission, abort mission. Act like nothing happened. So the whole thing's off, and they're like, ugh, we need a new plan. Meanwhile, police are still on the hunt for the Scarborough rapist. Between May and September of that year, 1990, they had collected over 130 DNA samples from different suspects. They also released a sketch of their suspect. And people who knew Paul saw it and they're like, does that kind of look like Paul? And this led to police wanting to talk to Paul. November 20th of that year, they interview him. And when they asked Paul if he knew why they were questioning him, he was like, yeah, I look like the guy in the sketch. And he was just super cooperative. He even willingly and happily gave DNA samples to them. And the police are like, this can't be our guy. If he was our guy, he would not be this cooperative. But they did take his DNA sample and they put it up on the shelf with all the 130 other ones, because back in the day, it's the early 90s, and DNA testing was not as streamlined as it is now. And so it would take a while to get through each sample. So he's just, his sample's put up with all the others and they're chipping away at him. The next month after being interviewed by the police, Carla and Paul are like, okay, we're ready to try this on Tammy again. The Homolkas were having this Christmas party, and they had people over at their house, and they're eating and drinking, including Tammy, who's underage, but, you know, Mrs. Homolka is a cool mom. She's like, do you want a little bit of alcohol, Tammy? Because if you do, I'd much rather you do it in the house. Tammy's just living her best life, and she's drinking and visiting with everybody. And Paul and Carla are like, let's do this. So they lace Tammy's drink with some sedative, like a heavier one than Valium that's really going to knock her out. To Carla, in her mind, she was about to give Paul the ultimate Christmas gift. After the party wrapped up, the parents went upstairs and went off to bed. Everybody's gone, and now it's just Paul and Carla and Tammy. And Tammy's pretty out of it because she's been drinking this alcohol that has sedatives in it, and so she's unconscious by this point. So Paul and Carla take Tammy downstairs, and Carla had stolen some halothane from work. And halothane is this clear, odorless liquid that's used as a general anesthetic. And she sprinkled some on a rag, and she put it over Tammy's face just to guarantee that she was very, very unconscious for at least as long as they needed her to be. And then they both undressed her, and Paul pulls out his video camera. You know, because it's the 90s, remember video cameras? And they took turns of videotaping one another while they raped her. Both of them. That's her sister. Ew, Carla. Ew, Paul. She's a kid. Ew. The whole thing's ew. While she was still unconscious, Tammy started to vomit. And then she started choking on her vomit. And it was to the point that she stopped breathing. And so Paul and Carla are freaking out. And they're like, what do we do? What do we do? So they try to revive her. And they can't. And they're like, we gotta call an ambulance about this. But before they do that, they put her clothes back on, get rid of any evidence, even though they just videotaped themselves. And an ambulance shows up and takes Tammy to the hospital, to St. Catherine's General Hospital. And she never regained consciousness. And after she was taken to the hospital, she was pronounced dead. She was gone. And it was Carla and Paul's freaking fault. When word got to the family that Tammy had passed away, Carla and her mom were, you know, hugging and crying quietly. And then there's Paul, who had this very visceral reaction. He's like huddled up in the corner, sitting with his knees up to his chest, and he's dry heaving and screaming no over and over, like ugly crying. And even Carla was probably like, Paul? Tammy had chemical burns on her face from that halothane, but authorities took Carla and Paul at their word. They were like, okay, yeah, that adds up. Mm-hmm. And they ruled her death accidental, that she had ingested alcohol, and because of that, she threw up and choked on it, and that's all that happened. After this, after her death at some point, Paul and Carla decided that they're going to be even more twisted and disturbing, and they went into Tammy's room, and Carla put on some of her dead sister's clothes, and they filmed themselves getting it on while Carla was wearing her sister's clothes, pretending to be Tammy. That's just so twisted. How does somebody's mind go there? After all of this, Paul and Carla decide that they need to move out and get a place of their own. They need to leave the Homolkas to grieve in peace. So they move into this cute little house. It's just the two of them. And this, unfortunately, gave them more than enough space to do this again. And after getting away with Tammy's death, they both had this sense of invincibility. Like, they were like, ooh, we got away with this, we can do it again. It just kind of fueled their gross passion. Carla started calling herself the keeper of Paul's virgins and told him that she lets him do it because she loves him. I think it's just, you know, her sick, twisted, obsessed way of keeping him happy and with her. They also decided after Tammy's death that they're going to start hunting other girls in honor of Tammy. The whole thing's just so friggin' weird. So the very next month, January 1991, Paul and Carla abduct a girl and they bring her home to their new house. Paul raped her while Carla watched, and then they put her in their car and they drove her off into a deserted road where they left her. And they referred to her as January Girl. Just so many layers of disrespect here. A couple months go by, and then in April, they target a girl who's 14. She's on a rowing team. And while she was out training, Carla waved at her from the car to kind of distract her. And then Paul came up behind her and grabbed her and pulled her into some nearby bushes where he sexually assaulted her. And then when he was done, he made her wait 5 minutes before she got out of the bushes so that he could disappear, get out of there. Their next victim was a 15-year-old girl that I read a couple different things. Either she was a friend of Tammy's or she was somebody that Carla had met at work at the vet clinic. But either way, Carla invited her over for a girls' night. It was 3 weeks before their wedding, and Carla and this girl were hanging out at her house, and they're drinking together and having a fun girls' night. And Carla, as she did with Tammy, because, you know, no lessons to be learned here, she laced her drink with something, knocked her out, and then once she was good and unconscious, she called Paul in, and she's like, "Your wedding gift's ready, babe." So Paul comes in, camera ready, and they both took turns filming each other while the other raped her. When the girl woke up, she had no idea what had happened because she was unconscious the whole time. She was sick and she was throwing up and she was nauseous, but she just thought she was hungover. She just thought she was having a good, fun girls' night with her girl, Carla. And so when Carla invited her over to do it again in August, she was like, "Yeah, sure, that sounds fun." This time they planned to do the same thing and things were going as planned until she stopped breathing. So they called an ambulance, but before the ambulance got there, they were able to revive her, and so they canceled the call. Earlier that summer, a couple months before this August happening, in June, Paul was out stealing license plates and he saw this 14-year-old girl named Leslie Mahaffey. Things are just going to escalate, okay? They're not going to stop with this. They need more. They're not just going to send, you know, drug girls and send them on their way. They need more. And so he sees Leslie and he goes over to her. Apparently, Leslie had been locked out of her house for missing curfew. It's like middle of the night, like early, early hours. And Paul approaches her and he's like, "Hey, thinking about breaking into one of your neighbor's houses." And Leslie's like, "Okay, do you have any cigarettes?" And he's like, "Actually, I do." So he leads her over to his car and he forces her into the car and blindfolds her and drives home with her in the car. And he leads her out of the car into the house and he's like, "Honey, I'm home and I brought a victim." And Carla's like, "Ooh." And as always, they videotape themselves doing their thing to this poor girl. And this time they're incorporating torture into the whole thing. And in the background, they've got Bob Marley playing, David Bowie, and they're just, the two of them are just having a great time. But then Leslie's blindfold slipped. And I don't really understand what happens next because she saw Paul. She asked him for cigarettes. He was like bragging to her that he was going to break into a neighbor's house. But because the blindfold slipped, Paul's like, "Oh my gosh, she's going to tell the police on us. She's going to be able to identify us." So he's like, "She needs to die." Their plan was to inject air into her bloodstream to stop her heart. But it's unclear how she died to this day. Paul's account of events is that Carla gave her a lethal dose of some drugs. And Carla's account is that Paul strangled her. Either way, this poor girl died at their hands. They put her body in the basement, and the next day they had Carla's family come over for a nice family dinner while there's a body in the basement. And then after dinner, after the family left, Paul's like, "Okay, we gotta get to work. We gotta get rid of this body." So Paul goes down to the hardware store and he picks up a dozen bags of cement and his grandfather's circular saw, and they dismember Leslie's body and they encase each part of her body in a block of cement. Then they take all these blocks of cement and they drive them about 11 miles away from their house to a lake where they dump the cement and the body parts into the lake. Their wedding day came. It was June 29th, so it's like maybe 2 weeks after this. And while they're vowing to love each other forever, a guy and his son were out fishing on that lake and they saw one of the blocks of cement and it was suspicious to them. So they notify the police about it. Leslie's body was identified through dental records. The parents are notified. As you can imagine, they're devastated. But Paul and Carla are not suspects at this point. About a month after their wedding in July, Paul set his sights on a new girl named Sydney Kirshen. She's 21 years old, and he started stalking her. And Sydney noticed that he is stalking her. So I think she was on foot, and he was in his car. And he's following her while she's walking, probably slash running at this point, to her boyfriend's house. And he's like trying to abduct her at this point. This day he was trying to abduct her. But she makes it to the boyfriend's house and she goes in and she tells him what's up. Like, there's this creepy guy and he's been following me. So the boyfriend comes out of the house and chases him off. But he got Paul's license plate number and reported it to the police. So an officer shows up at Paul's house. But ultimately, I'm not quite sure what happened, but they did not submit an official report. And this whole experience kind of jolted Paul. He was like, oh, that was a close call. So he's like, I better take a break for a while. But Paul, he just couldn't help himself. He couldn't stay away. And in March of 1992, he was on the prowl again. On March 29th, he's driving around. He's on the prowl. He's on the hunt. And he spots these two sisters out walking around. Their names were Shanna and Carrie. And he pulls out his big old video camera and starts filming them. And you know, it's the 90s. So video cameras were not all slim and stealthy like they are now. And Shanna and Carrie see him. And they're like, this is creepy. I think that's a bad guy over there. They tried to remember his license plate number because, you know, they don't have a pen and paper handy and they don't have an iPhone with notes. So they're trying to remember it so that they can report it to police. And they did report it, but they got the number wrong. And so Paul once again got away. And just a couple weeks later, on the afternoon of April 16th, Paul and Carla were out driving around, literally driving around, looking for a new victim. And they spotted a 15-year-old girl named Kristen French, who was walking home from school. And they're like, perfect. So they pull up ahead of her, and they park in a church parking lot, and they wait for her to start walking by. And as she starts to walk by, Carla comes out of the car and she's got a map in hand and she's pretending to be confused and lost. And so she calls Kristen over and she's like, hey, can you help me? And so Kristen, being a kind person, is like, yeah, sure. So she walks over to Carla, and while they're both, you know, looking at this map, Paul sneaks up behind her and attacks her at knife point and forces her into the car. And then Carla gets in the back seat. So Kristen's in the front seat. Carla's sitting behind her in the back seat, and she's holding on to her hair, and that's how they're kind of subduing her. Kristen always came right home after school. She would walk home every day from school and immediately go home because she had a dog that she had to take care of. So when she didn't show up, her parents got worried. So they called the police immediately, and within 24 hours, there was a search launched. It turns out that there had been several witnesses from different vantage points who saw Kristen forced into the car. They also found one of her shoes at the parking lot that she was taken from. Meanwhile, Carla and Paul have Kristen back at their house, and they're doing what they do, torturing, raping, video recording. They also forced Kristen to drink large amounts of alcohol, and this went on for 3 days. But Kristen refused to be broken down. She, as time went on, she just became more and more defiant, which, you know, Paul hated. It made him so mad. She told him, quote, you can take my body, but not my will. So Paul's enraged, and he's trying to get her to comply. So he's like, I'm going to show her video of Leslie. So he pulls out the video camera, and he's showing Kristen what happened to Leslie. And Kristen's just staying stone-faced, and it's making Paul even madder. Carla had left the room at some point to go take a shower, and when she came back, she found that Paul had Kristen on her knees, and her hands were tied behind her back with an electrical cord, and she also had a cord around her neck. And Paul's talking to her about death, and Kristen's just staying calm. And then Paul strangled her while Carla watched, and he strangled her for 7 minutes. He really wanted to make sure that she was dead. And Paul's looking at Carla, and he's like, listen, I chose to do it this way because I've been choked before, and it's a pleasant way to die, Carla. It causes a euphoric feeling. So it was good. Like, it was good. Just trust me. Isn't that thoughtful? So thoughtful of Paul. Wow, Paul, you're so thoughtful. Maybe you'll get into heaven after all. And then Paul looks at his watch, and he's like, oh, we're going to be late. They had Easter dinner plans at Carla's parents' house, and, you know, they didn't want to be late for that. So they cover up Kristen's body with a blanket, and they head on over to the in-laws to celebrate Easter. And then that night, when they got home around 9:30 p.m., they went to clean up the evidence. They cut off all of Kristen's hair just to make sure that there weren't any carpet fibers or anything caught in it that would lead back to them. And then Carla took Kristen's body into the bathroom and she bathed her body to get rid of any DNA evidence. And then they loaded Kristen up in the car and drove to the lake. And about 500 yards away from where they had left Leslie's body, they dumped Kristen's body into a ditch. She was still naked from her bath and they covered her up with leaves and dirt and branches and whatever they could find. And then they left and they burned all the evidence, including her hair, her jewelry, and the blanket that they used to cover up her body while they were celebrating the resurrection of Jesus. A couple weeks went by, and there was a passerby near the lake who stumbled upon Kristen's body. And at first, they were like, imagine how you would feel if you stumbled across a dead body. You wouldn't go, oh, dead body. Your mind would probably go, oh, carpet. Or a mannequin. Like, your first thought wouldn't be a dead body, probably, right? So that's what this person thought. They're like, oh, maybe it's just an old rolled up piece of carpet or an old conveyor belt. Like, a conveyor belt. All the things but a dead body. And then it occurred to them that, okay, yeah, this is a dead body and I need to call the police. When police showed up, they knew immediately that they had a really, really icky bad crime on their hands. This was not accidental. Because Paul's name had been brought up several times to the police because of all these stalking incidents, they went to his house, and as usual, Paul was kind and gracious in their presence. He was nice, he was clean cut, he definitely didn't look like somebody who would do this. And this, together with the fact that he drove a Nissan and not a Camaro, which was what the report stated the suspect drove, they were like, yeah, this isn't our guy.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
There's no way this guy is responsible for Kristen's death. But they're still looking. So 3 days later, a task force was created to figure out who killed Leslie and Kristen. And Paul and Carla are like, we better change our names. So they did. They changed their names from Bernardo to Teal. In December of that year, 1992, Paul's DNA was still sitting on the shelf. Well, it was finally tested that month. Five people showed up having the same markers tying back to these crimes, and Paul was one of them. So they sent his DNA off for further testing, and in February of 1993, labs showed that, surprise, Paul was the Scarborough rapist. I know, you're so surprised. He was put on 24-hour surveillance, and police learned that he had recently been arrested on charges of assault, but then he was let go. Apparently, just a couple months earlier, on December 27th, him and Carla got into a little bit of an altercation. He'd used a flashlight to hit her head, her arms, her leg, her face, all the body parts he's hitting with a flashlight. His betrothed, that's his woman. He's hitting her with a flashlight. When this was reported, Carla didn't immediately disclose that it was Paul who had done it. She just told people that she had a bad accident. She ended up missing almost a week of work. And when she went back to work on January 4th, she knew she was going to have to come up with a story because she still had bruises and marks all over her body. So when her coworkers are like, are you okay? What happened? She was like, yeah, I got into a car accident. And they're like, that seems like a lie. So they're skeptical, right? And they're worried about their friend Carla. So they decide to call Carla's parents about it. Carla's parents obviously are worried about their daughter. So they show up to Carla and Paul's house and they're trying to help Carla. But Carla didn't want their help. They ended up having to physically remove her from the house and try to get her into their car. But Carla was able to escape their grip and she ran back into the house and she was like frantically searching for something. But eventually they were able to get her down to the hospital. And while she was there, she gave a statement, her injuries were documented, and she finally, while she was there, admitted that yes, it was Paul. He hit me with a flashlight. The charges were filed against Paul. He was arrested, but then he was released on his own recognizance. So after the DNA test findings and learning about what he'd done to his own wife, police were starting to realize what this a-hole was capable of. At this point, Carla had moved out of their house and she was staying with some relatives about an hour and a half away. And on February 9th, investigators came out to interview Carla. And while they're interviewing her, she learned about their suspicions of Paul and what has been going on and what they thought was going on and that he's the bad guy. But she kept the focus on his abuse towards her. And so the investigators leave and Carla's just, she's in a bad place. And she decides to open up to her aunt and uncle, who she's staying with, about what her and Paul had been doing. She told them all about how Paul's a Scarborough rapist and that she, with Paul, was involved in what happened to Leslie and Kristen. And they had it all on tape. At this point, police are like, oh, maybe we should reopen the investigation on Tammy now that we have this information. And Carla met with an attorney. Carla was also put on 24-hour surveillance. And after lots of conversation with her attorney, he was starting to realize that maybe Carla was not as innocent in all of this as she was making herself out to be. But he wasn't quite sure what her role in everything was. He was seeking legal immunity for Carla in exchange for her cooperation against Paul. But of course, she was told that, you know, shaping up, that Carla's not so innocent here and full immunity is not an option for her. Paul ended up being arrested on February 17th and his house was searched for 71 days. 71 days. There were lots of tapes, but the only one that they found was one where Carla was sexually assaulting one of the girls who would go on to be known as Jane Doe in court. But they also discovered that Paul had a little diary. He had written detailed descriptions of all of his attacks. Since Carla was not going to be able to get immunity, her attorney was trying to get a plea deal going for her. She had been charged on 2 counts of manslaughter, and he was trying to get 12 years each for Leslie and Kristen. So 24 years total. He also insisted that she be eligible for parole after 3 years served. And they really wanted to make this plea deal work because they needed Carla's testimony against Paul. Her attorney also wanted her to serve in a psychiatric unit and not in a jail cell. But Carla was still insisting that she get full immunity. She's like, I don't want no plea deal. I want immunity. She claimed that she had just been under Paul's thumb. He made her do all of this. He was the mastermind behind it all. She was just his puppet. But her attorney's like, Carla, listen, I know you want immunity. We all do, but it's just not an option, sweetie. And she's like, fine, I'll take the plea deal. In March, she was transferred to a psychiatric unit and she was put on medication. And while she was there, she wrote a letter to her parents and her little sister, Lori. The letter said, quote, Dear Mom and Dad and Lori, this is the hardest letter I've ever had to write, and you'll probably all hate me once you've read it. I've kept this inside myself for so long, and I just can't lie to you anymore. Both Paul and I are responsible for Tammy's death. Paul was in love with her and wanted to have sex with her. He wanted me to help him. He wanted me to get sleeping pills from work to drug her with. He threatened me and physically and emotionally abused me when I refused. No words I can say can make you understand what he put me through. So stupidly, I agreed to do as he said. But something, maybe the combination of drugs and the food she ate that night, caused her to vomit. I tried so hard to save her. I'm so sorry, but no words I can say can bring her back. I've thought many times of killing myself, but I couldn't put you through the pain again of losing another daughter and sister again. I don't blame you at all if you hate me. I hate myself. I live with the pain of knowing I unintentionally killed my baby sister every day. I think that's the real reason I put up with Paul's abusive behavior. I felt I deserved it for allowing him to drug and rape my beautiful baby sister. I loved her so much, and I never wanted to do anything to hurt my Tamsykins. Please believe me. I would gladly give my life for hers. Nothing I can do or say can bring her back. I don't expect you to ever forgive me, for I will never forgive myself. Carla. On May 6th, Paul sent his attorney to his house to collect the rest of the tapes. He instructed him that they were hidden inside a light on the ceiling. And so the lawyer went, and sure enough, there they were. Paul told him, don't watch them. Just trust me. Do not watch them. And so his attorney just took them, gathered them up, and kept them as a secret. What a stellar attorney. Carla had taken that plea deal, remember, to testify against Paul. And so on May 17th, she took investigators to her and Paul's house to collect more evidence. And while they were there, they found the receipts from Paul's little trip to the hardware store to get all that concrete, remember? Just a brilliant criminal, keeping that receipt. They also found a buttload of DNA evidence. While Carla was in this psychiatric unit, she underwent a bunch of testing. And this testing found that she wasn't this abused and beaten down woman under her man's thumb, like she claimed. Rather, she was a psychopath. She had a typical case of hybristophilia, which means that she was sexually aroused by criminals and bad guys doing bad things. It turned her on when Paul committed crimes, hence the reason she supported and encouraged him to do it. On June 28th, all this is just one after another. June 28th, Carla stood trial, and on July 6th, she was sentenced to 12 years in prison. 12 years! Please! In 1994, Paul and Carla were granted a divorce, and that summer, finally, it crossed Paul's attorney's mind that maybe it wasn't ethical to keep those tapes hidden. So he contacted his own attorney, who advised him to seal up the tapes and deliver them by hand to a judge, and then remove himself as Paul's counsel. So that's what he did. And so now these tapes, that's damning evidence, right? Well, unfortunately, Carla had already taken the plea deal and been tried, and so these tapes couldn't touch her. When the public caught wind of this and found out what happened, they were so mad. Carla, she got off way too easy. Paul's trial finally came in 1995, and on September 1st, he was convicted of all charges. He also admitted to a crime that they didn't have on him. He was like, well, might as well. And thank goodness he did, because in 1987, he had attacked somebody, and there was somebody else who was serving time for that attack. So thankfully, that person was exonerated. So Paul's in prison. Under Canadian law, he can apply for parole after serving 25 years. But he's already been denied twice, and most recently, he was denied in June of 2021. And so he sits rotting in jail where he should be. Their reason for the denial of parole was that he hasn't shown that the risk of him reoffending can be managed. And Paul's argument is that he was in his 20s. He's a totally different person now. He also said that he feels like his time in prison is cruel and unusual punishment. Okay, Paul. Carla herself is currently a free woman. She was released with bond conditions in July of 2005. And then the conditions were dropped in November of that year because there wasn't enough evidence to impose them. This bee got off so easily. She went and she got a bachelor's degree in psychology, which is wild and ironic. In 2006, she wanted to change her name again. So she filed to change it to Emily Tremblay. Just has more of a star quality. But she was rejected. So now she's known as Leanne Teal because Leanne is her middle name, I think. And Teal, they had changed from Bernardo to Teal a while ago. After she was released from prison, she married her attorney's brother. Oh, a love story came out of it. I would love to hear this story. They have three children together. They're living in Canada. And for a while, she was volunteering at her kid's school. And you can imagine how well this went over with the other parents and the public in general. And her husband came to her defense. He's like, if it bothers them so much, they can just move. Like, he really said that. He also said, nothing has happened in 10 years. Why are you so worried? Okay. This attorney's brother really is so dumb. In 2015, Paul self-published a book on Amazon. It was called A Mad World Order, and it was a violent, fictional ebook, but the public didn't like that, and so it was removed from the site. As of today, Paul is still in prison, and hopefully he will die there. Appreciate you being here. If you want to hear more stories from me, you can check out my podcast. I will link it in the description box. If you want more videos from me, click the subscribe button. I think there's a little bell icon that you can click to turn on notifications for when I put out new videos. Until next time, take care of yourself, and I will see you later.